it's done.
Connor McDavid! It's not real!
The goal of the year.
Panarin!
Part of the past. The celebrations. Forgotten. The history.
Vegas Golden Knights!
History. We're back to a blank slate. Clean ice. All that matters now is what happens next. The Stanley Cup Playoffs.
Eastern Conference Final begins Wednesday.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, welcome to the Snooker Scene Podcast. I'm Dave Hendon. A week today, it'll be the last day of the World Championship. The trophy will be presented, and then they'll start dismantling it all, and it'll all be over for another year. So enjoy it while it's here. The second round, and we'll get onto this shortly, the second round is probably the worst, really, as a spectacle, because it does drag on a bit. There's a lot of sessions without finishes. You need close matches to keep people really interested. Now, we've had some close frames, actually, within matches. Look at the Jack Jones-CJ Wee match. Objectively, the standard was poor. Jack Jones said that himself, and he won it. But the second session in particular was very exciting. I mean, there were lots of frames on the black in that match. Jack won five of the six that were on the black. Those were the close frames. There's all sorts going on. It was very exciting. The standard itself wasn't great. And the standard overall in this World Championship, let's cut to the chase, has not been great. The centuries count is way down. There's a number of factors for this. One is the top players in general have underperformed all year, apart from, obviously, Ronnie O'Sullivan, Judd Trump, Mark Allen. They're the three sort of big winners of the season, multiple winners of the season. Between them, they've won 13 tournaments. So, they're still in the tournament as well, significantly. But outside of that, you know, obviously, Neil Robertson didn't qualify. Mark Selby, you know, lost first round. Sean Murphy is out. Luca Brasel lost first round. So a lot of the big hitters, in general, during the season have not performed. I think the weather as well has had an impact on playing conditions. It got quite damp. The tables are playing a bit heavy. The pockets are tight. There's just no two ways about it. They're tight. In the past, they played generously. They're now brutal. There can actually be a middle ground between the two, which is where kind of they should be. We're seeing frames where, you know, someone's on for a big break, they suddenly miss. I think it's careful what you wish for on that. You know, I don't like people who constantly bang on about how big the pockets are, because you can get an overcorrection for that. And I don't think it's attractive to have, you know, tournaments where people can't pot a ball into certain pockets. People who say, there's this strange sort of argument, oh, well, you know, we'll make it as hard as we can for them. It's a little bit like getting to Wimbledon and saying, well, let's let the grass grow for a month before they play. The players want the best conditions to perform. Okay? Simple as that. Now, the pockets shouldn't be too big, but equally, they shouldn't be too small. And this year, they're pretty, pretty tough. And I wonder if when we get to the one table, that may be taken into consideration. Anyway, the tournament itself, of course, is still fascinating. It always is. And we're on this sort of strange day where it doesn't feel like there's much happening yet. As I record this, we haven't started yet. But obviously, there's going to be four finishes, and we'll have our quarterfinal lineup confirmed. We already know Judd Trump's going to play Jack Jones. And we know David Gilbert is going to play Stephen Maguire. It looks very much like Ronnie O'Sullivan will win, although, of course, he was 10-6 up in the quarterfinals last year. Luca Brasel beats him. I don't see a Ryan Day comeback, and you can obviously play this back if that happens. Feel free. We've got a couple of close ones. We've got Stuart Bingham 9-7 up on Jack Lazowski. I thought Lazowski threw a couple of frames away on Sunday, but he's not out that match yet as we record this. This will be out of date very soon, I know. Karen Wilson, you would think, would come through against Joe O'Connor. He's 10-6 up. And then Mark Allen, John Higgins, 9-7 Allen. I mean, that's been... slugfest is the word, really. High quality at times, but two sort of proper players going at it. Higgins could still win that, but I think Mark Allen is the favourite. But people be saying, well, it's all very well talking about the World Championship. What about the Kit Kat break for World Champions? Now, this is a tournament I mentioned at the start of my campaign in the last podcast. And, you know, it's the talk of the nation. I think people... You go to supermarkets... you go into doctors' waiting rooms, it's all anyone's talking about, including Tony Curran, who said, I'll explain what the tournament is first, if you haven't heard the chatter. The Kit Kat break for world champions, 1985, only time it was held, sponsored by Kit Kat. And it was for all living world champions, and they played a tournament. Dennis Taylor won it. He was, of course, the reigning world champion. But my argument is, if we're going to leave the Crucible, and there's lots of correspondence on that coming up, by the way, if we're going to leave the Crucible, as a legacy to remember it, we should have a tournament. It could be a weekend tournament. The last eight world champions are invited to play in it, and it honours the Crucible, and it honours that era of the world championship. So the last eight world champions get to play in it every year. Obviously, if there's a new world champion, that the eighth man drops out, etc., etc. But Kit Kat Braver World Champions, that's my campaign. And Tony Curran has written, he says, enjoying the podcast as usual. I think your idea for a return of the Kit Kat tournament at the Crucible is a great one. It could keep everyone happy. I'd pay good money to see it. See you at Hyde Park Corner. Well, yes, that is where, of course, we're meeting to start our march on Downing Street. Well, thank you, Tony. But more seriously, let's hear some words about the Crucible. It's a venue that means a lot to a lot of people. And John Byrne has written a lovely email here, which I'm going to read out in its entirety, John. In fact, I'll just take a refreshing beverage before I do. Here we go. John writes, it's Saturday morning as I write this, and I've just returned from a first ever trip to the Crucible. As someone who's been watching and loving the sport for over 30 years, this was, to put it mildly, a bucket list trip. Or perhaps pilgrimage would be more an appropriate word. Starting in Limerick in Ireland, where I'm from, out to Shannon Airport, onward to Gatwick, then a night in Croydon, where my sister lives, and finally on to Sheffield itself. Excitement and anticipation building with every stage of the journey. Walking through the winter gardens, out onto Tudor Square and across the square to the Crucible itself, was a genuinely emotional and can't quite believe I'm finally here moment. Not just for me, but for my travelling companion, namely the aforementioned sister, who is a fellow Jimmy White obsessive, suffered alongside me through all of the great man's agonising near misses. Entering the foyer of the venue for the first time was a curious experience because of that almost dreamlike sense of being somewhere new and somewhere that felt intimately familiar at the same time. A feeling only amplified when we stepped through the double doors into the main arena itself. For quite a while we didn't say much, just tried to soak it all in. Right down there I had to remind myself in that very spot is where Dennis Taylor sunk the final black in 85. And over there was where Jimmy missed that black in 94. And there too was where Cliff sank to his knees in 83 after that magical maximum. The memories just kept coming. So long before we'd seen a player introduced or a single ball potted, we both felt exhilarated and overwhelmed in the best possible sense of that word. We got to enjoy five sessions in all, the conclusion of Tom Ford v Ricky Walden with the added bonus of Carter v Maguire once the divide went up, the gripping final session of Selby v O'Connor, the rather less gripping first session of Milkins v Pang Jung-soo, the superb first nine frames of Lazowski v Ding, and the thrilling and nerve-shredding finale of Si Jo-wee v Mark Williams. But back to the venue itself, and something you yourself said on Eurosport as the drama of Jack Jones and Si Jo-wee played itself out on Friday evening. This room, you said, this Crucible Theatre. And somehow these words succinctly summed up my own feelings and experiences of being there. It may seem an obvious point to make, but until you're there, in your seat, you don't fully appreciate the theatricality of that space. And ultimately, that's what separates and distinguishes it from any sporting venue I've ever visited. You're watching sport, of course, elite-level sport at that. But the crucial difference is that you're watching it in a theatre, a place and space specifically designed for drama, tragedy, humour, pathos, farce, and everything in between. So it's not just that the Crucible is a great venue for this great sport because of its size and intimacy. It's a great venue for the sport because it's not really a sporting venue at all. And it's only by visiting it and absorbing it and being captivated by it that I fully appreciated that. The Crucible as a theatre was a space purpose-built to amplify tension, drama and emotion. The fact that it became the perfect venue for snooker, a sport that's completely infused with tension, drama and emotion, is really just a beautiful and happy accident. I know it looks like its days are last numbered as of the venue for this great championship, but snooker fans who have been lucky enough to visit it, even just once, will no doubt always remember it for what it is. Snooker's Theatre of Dreams. A place that's elevated and amplified the game into the realms of high drama. Apologies for the length of the email, and thanks again for this superb podcast. Long may it continue. Well, John, no apologies required at all. I thought that was just a lovely email that perfectly sums up what the venue means to people. And, it's actually quite emotional reading that, to be honest with you. I'm glad you enjoyed your trip. And you're quite right. There is something about the space that amplifies everything that's already good about snooker. The mistake people make, well, it's not a mistake, it's a money thing. They think, oh, more seats, more drama. Actually, the opposite's true. The more intimate a space, you know, the more, also, the more of a sort of a collective experience for the audience. The fact that, basically, wherever you are in that theatre, you can see what's happening, which is not true of a lot of venues. John, that's a brilliant email. Thank you for kicking us off this week. As you can imagine, we've had a lot of emails about Crexit, as it's been dubbed by one of our listeners, the possibility of the Crucible no longer hosting the World Championship after 2027 when the contract runs out. Eric writes, Eric Eggert, thanks for keeping us updated on the goings-on from the Crucible. I'm personally baffled by the discussions about the Crucible as a venue for the World Championship. I don't see how a bigger, better venue will improve the Championship as a tournament. Snooker is an incredibly samey-looking sport. It's inside. You have a well-defined table. Venue and formats, however, do make a difference. The size of the Ali Pali, the roaring crowds at the shootout, the uncomfortable constraints of the Crucible. I think the players who complain about the Crucible must understand that, at least for those of us watching at home, and hence paying indirectly much of the prize money, it's a benefit that they need to sit next to each other, that it's crowded and uncomfortable. Putting a snooker table into any other generic venue and calling it the World Championship will never be as exciting as it is right now. Put new tournaments on in new venues. It might not be as much money as you can make by selling the championship, but if you can get a few going, it might be worth it. I mean, this is obviously... We're saying all this, and I don't disagree with you, Eric, at all. We're saying all this without having had the chance to see it in another venue. You know, if they took it... Let's just say they took it to the Tempodrome in Berlin. It might be brilliant. We don't know. But... in terms of what we feel about the World Championship, obviously this venue, you know, is a big part of that. And the two go together. It's the World Championship at the Crucible. Connor Langham in Dublin. Firstly, thanks for all the podcasts. I've listened from the start and loved all the variations over the years from duos at the start with Clive Everton, lockdown duo with Michael McMullen, snooker bingo, Crucible previews, past championship reviews with Neil Falls, Allen and Phil Yates, and for the last while, the solo podcast. They've all been brilliant, so well done. Well, thank you, Connor. Okay, so to main point, the Crexit debate, as someone put it last week, and I want the term to catch on. For those that don't know, it's the Crucible leaving Sheffield. This would concern me because the idea is that due to all the phenomenal interest in the World Championship, they could sell two or three times this amount. Yes, that's true, but that is because of the Crucible. Everyone wants to see the Crucible, and also I believe it's because of knowing where it is each year, which is something that we have always said why the tournaments haven't worked, as they've moved too much. So yes, it would sell two or three times over in its current location, but that would happen. But would that happen in another location? I'd be concerned if we moved to Saudi, to a big venue. It would only be half full. If it stayed, certainly in Europe, there may be a chance of getting those numbers, but if it goes anywhere, I believe all those people who want tickets now are doing it because of the Crucible and the familiarity, so wouldn't necessarily want the tickets if it's somewhere else. So either way, I think it would need time, like a few years, to settle in somewhere new. Sorry for the long email. Well, I would say sorry for the long podcast, Connor, to be honest with you. Thank you, Connor, for that. Nothing wrong with the length of the email. we've got a lot of correspondence on this, of course. Chris Boyle, thanks for the great work on your various outlets during the World Championship. And also a recommendation for Alan McManus's podcast, an equally excellent listen. Well, Alan's keeping that going, as I knew he would. And it's a perfect length for me. I think without sort of letting daylight in on magic, I enjoy two cups of green tea every morning when I get up. And his sort of 25-minute podcast is the perfect length to boil the kettle, drink the first cup, boil the kettle again, drink the second cup. It's probably needless information there. But anyway, Alan continues there. Check that out on the various platforms. Chris says, as a Sheffield resident who leans firmly towards maintaining sports romance and heritage, I'll declare at the outset that my sympathies are unsurprisingly with remaining at the Crucible forevermore. I accept personal views inevitably impact how one views the increasingly noisy and tedious debate and jostling for position as the end of the contract approaches. Listening to the arguments put forward by Barry Hearn recently, while made with typical conviction, I've left with the image of a poker player who just maybe doesn't hold as many aces as he'd like the world to think. Barry is obviously as shrewd and battle-hardened as they come. While money is clearly a huge factor, I strongly suspect he isn't naive enough to not take anything else into account, nor to either completely ignore the many sage voices who advocate for remaining, or unaware of the unintended consequence a move may bring. In the medium to long term, I would tend to concur that change is inevitable. In terms of post-2027, I would be entirely surprised if the World Championship were to remain at its spiritual home for a few more years yet. Rather than size trumping all other factors, could an argument be made that holding your biggest event in the most special, if compact, venue actually increases its allure and prestige to punters, sponsors and TV. Or, of course, I could be completely wrong. I've registered for next year's pre-sale to be on the safe side anyway. Well, I mean, we're getting... I mean, obviously, I understand this is a snooker podcast, snooker fans write in, but the point that's being made over and over again is the reason so many people want to go to the World Championship is because it's at the Crucible and it's built up this incredible reputation over the best part of half a century and people want to be part of it. We've heard already people have been there for the first time. It's a pilgrimage. It feels special going there. And this is all to the credit of the championship. It's symbiotic. The World Championship at the Crucible, they go together. Now, obviously, all that sentiment completely ignores commercial factors. Here's my view, though, and I kind of said this last time. There's a lot of sort of kite flying and things being said in the public sphere for other people to hear. If World Snooker Tour, and let's say Barry Hearn, because Barry was the one who fronted up there to talk, if they really want the tournament in Saudi Arabia for all the money that's been offered, they would have announced that already, okay? They are renegotiating the BBC contract, and the BBC will not want it in Saudi Arabia for various reasons. One of the main ones is, and this is, no one ever talks about this, but I have mentioned it before, and it is significant. One of the reasons, it's not the only reason, but one of the reasons the BBC shows so much snooker is because it fulfills a very important, and it's a technical thing, but it is important to them. They have to produce, they have to show 25% of their output produced by independent producers, i.e. not in-house at the BBC. All the snooker coverage, and they're the host broadcaster, is produced by an independent company. So all the hours they show goes massively towards, at the course of the year, that 25%. If they were no longer the host broadcaster and just bought in the coverage from somewhere else, none of that would apply. So they would actually lose a lot of hours from independent producers. So that is actually a factor. It doesn't sound... It's a bit nerdy. It's a bit sort of TV inside baseball stuff. But actually, that is important. And the BBC don't want to lose snooker. I don't think World Snooker want to lose the BBC. So put it together, I don't think it is going to go to Saudi Arabia. And it doesn't need to. They're already building up big events in Saudi. They don't need the World Championship. They'd like it, maybe. And there may come a point where they offer so much money, World Snooker can't turn it down. But I think it's very clear... And this is my analysis, and it might backfire, but I'm just bringing whatever insight you think I have, that's what I'm bringing to it. I think it will remain in Britain, probably not at the Crucible. So we've seen the success of something like Manchester Central. It may go to London or a big city. I don't think it will be in Saudi Arabia in 2028. That's my prediction, because World Snooker still want to keep the BBC. I said this last time. I asked the question, the only question really that needs asking, can they live without the BBC? If they can't, it ain't going abroad. Now, that's what I'm saying now. We'll see how it plays out. Joe Richards on this subject. I wonder if they did crowdfunding to save the Crucible and could raise £20 million to build a new venue. It'd be interesting to see. The World Championship staying in Sheffield, UK, brings a lot of happiness to many people in the UK. I feel like even if it flopped, it would easily raise a few million. I wonder if that would be a good idea. The power of the people may be able to compete with the Saudi money. I feel like an idea that could get some traction. It's hard not to like Barry Hearn at times. The man has got a lot of charisma. The man came across like a total pig in his interview, though. I see past the charm and charisma, and he just comes across like a know-it-all businessman. There's not important things that business and money. I think you've missed a few words out there, but anyway, I think we get the point. The more money I've earned in life, the less I've appreciated money, because I've realised there's more important things in life. I'm a mortgage advisor, and the amount of simpletons I come across that earn good money is frightening. As soon as we start judging everything based on money, it's a sad day. Give me a highlight educated doctor on a good wage over a millionaire that's been lucky and found a gap in the market any day of the week. I don't judge people by how much money they have in their bank account. Barry Hearn has lost my respect with his interview. The man is a smarmy know-it-all. Well, it's quite trenchant, Joe, I have to say, but the problem really with the interview Barry did is a lot of it was true, and of course people don't want to hear the truth. When he says money does trump sentiment, that is actually true with a lot of the players. And it's not just the top players who think, oh, I could earn a £5 million first prize. As I said last time, a lot of the low-ranked players who are losing early in the tournament are thinking, well, at the moment, if I lose my first match, I get £5 grand. I might be on 30 if we go somewhere else. It might not be nice to hear, but that's how they think. It's interesting how much support his interview actually got from players online when fans were absolutely incandescent about what he was saying. So that what was hard to hear for me, actually, was that I knew a lot of people would agree with him. Well, now we have another email here, which is interesting. Richie Turner, just to pick up on a point from the interviews Rachel Casey and Hazel Irvin had with Barry Hearn. While I agree they were good with interesting questions, my first two questions would have been, where is Steve Dawson? That's number one. Number two, who is actually running this game and making the decisions? If the answer to the second question is Barry Hearn, then what is Steve Dawson being paid to do? If the answer is that Dawson is in charge, then I'm not really interested in hearing Barry Hearn's opinion. I want to hear from Steve Dawson and where he thinks the World Championship should go after 2027. Well, other people have made this point, Richie, including Sean Murphy. Steve Dawson, obviously, is the chairman of World Snooker Tour. He's been Barry's right-hand man for many years. I mean, in terms of Rachel and Hazel, they've only got 7 or 8 minutes to do those interviews, so understandably, they want to focus on the issue of the World Championship, because that's what people want to hear about, rather than sort of who should be here, who shouldn't be here. You see this in politics. Certain politicians are sent on, you know, sort of breakfast TV shows because they're, sort of, in theory, good performers on TV, and I don't think anyone denies that Barry is that. But it's a fair question. He's supposed to have retired. I mean, it was announced 2 years ago he retired. He's president of Matchroom, but that's sort of supposed to be a sort of honorary role almost. Is he still the man making the decisions? If so, what exactly is the role of the chairman? I don't think it's unreasonable for people to want to hear from Steve Dawson, the chairman. The problem he's got is, obviously, there's no one there who's going to be as... Well, maybe Eddie Hearn is the only one who's going to be as good on telly as Barry. But he's been there 2 years. World Snooker Tour have had 2 years to give him media training. I suggested that right from the outset, because I know Steve has spent most of his time, and he's very well regarded, by the way, but he spent most of his time sort of in the back seat, if you like, out of the limelight. But they had an opportunity to give him media training. Have they done that? They give players media training. Why not the chairman? They do need to put him on telly. They do need to put him in front of people doing interviews, because he, we're told, is the chairman. And I'm not, you know, there's no suggestion that he's not doing a good job otherwise, but in issues like this, it is a bit odd to see someone who is supposed to have retired, you know, speaking on behalf of World Snooker, as opposed to the people who actually are supposed to be running World Snooker. I don't think that's unreasonable, the point you make. And other people have made it, particularly Sean Murphy, and I've heard other people make it as well. We're going to go back to the Kit Kat break for World Champions here, and Lee Wall, and there's a lot of puns here, and I, you know, I don't mind puns, but anyway, I'll just read it out. Lee says, you mooted that the Kit Kat break for World Champions should return. This really takes the biscuit. The overwhelming pressure of such a prestigious tournament would lead to negative snooker. I don't think it's right. It's the right way for WST to go. Okay. There's more, don't worry. You would have a break where players would just nestle into the reds. Works better written down, that. Two fingers to that, I say. I hope your plans for such a confection are foiled. I do concede it would sell tickets, though. The Crucible would be chock-a-block. Well, we got through that. Thank you very much. Thank you also to Charlie Smythe for your kind words about something I said. I'm not going to read it out, Charlie, if you don't mind, but it's kind of you to say what you said. I think we've done the Crucible debate for now, but a lot of people are asking about the other story that's sort of, if you like, blown up, about the breakaway tour, or supposed breakaway tour. Well, we've got some questions here. I'll just read them out. We still do about the Crucible as well. Gareth Hewitt, thanks for your informative podcast, which I really enjoy listening to. Just a few thoughts and questions for you. Thank you, Gareth. Regarding Crexit, do Barry Hearn's comments not seem contradictive? He seems so strongly to suggest that he would like to keep the World Championship in Sheffield, but also they'll go where the money is, as that is the most important thing to him. Surely if he wanted Sheffield City Council to resolve the issues with limited seating, and they hear these comments, they are less likely to want to invest the large sums of money to improve the facilities, if there's a chance the heads of World Snooker might move it away to somewhere with a bigger budget a few years later. I mean, that's a good point, isn't it? You know, if put it this way, say Sheffield City Council did build a new venue, then they would definitely want a long-term commitment, literally, I would say 20 years, to keep it there, because otherwise, in a few years' time, World Snooker might say, well, thanks for building that, but we're off somewhere else. So, I mean, that's a good point. To continue, says, to speed things up where there are a lot of misses, I like how the Six Red World Championship previously resolved this with the cue ball being given as ball in hand after three misses. Do you agree this would be a fair and quicker way of resolving such impasses? Probably not, actually, because often, ball in hand for three misses, well, you've still got to put it back a couple of times then. So often the time that's taken actually is with the first replacement. Once you've established the first time, then in theory it should speed up. To continue, can you shed any light on the breakaway tour? If World Snooker's deals with Saudi Arabia and China already in place, I presume the big money exhibitions will be agreed to take place at times which don't clash with main tour events. If so, why did Mark Williams seem to indicate he may not be back at the Crucible? Would players who sign up for those events not be allowed to compete on the main tour? I hope not, as this would greatly diminish the tour. Maybe Mark meant that eventually he would miss it when he does eventually retire or fail to qualify. And you go on here, I'll continue. It's impressive how the class of 92 have won so many world titles between them, despite the stiff competition from one another. I thought I'd be able to point out, however, that a lot of times other players have prevented them from winning the title. But it turns out they played each other at the Crucible more often than I thought. Anyway, I didn't totally waste my time, so here's the research. Since the 93 World Championship, which was the first they could all potentially qualify for, so he's listed the meetings of the class of 92 at the Crucible. So, I mean, I will read these out. It's quite a long list, but 96, Ronnie beat John in the quarters. 98, John beat Ronnie in the semis. 99, Mark beat John in the semis. 2000, Mark beat John in the semis. 2001, Ronnie beat John in the final. 2006, Ronnie beat Mark in the quarters. 07, John beat Ronnie in the quarters. 08, Ronnie beat Mark in the second round. 2010, Ronnie beat Mark in the second round. 2011, John beat Ronnie in the quarters and John beat Mark in the semis. 2012, Ronnie beat Mark in the second round. The final in 2018, Mark beat John. 2020 quarters, Ronnie beat Mark. 2021 second round, Mark beat John. 2022 semis, Ronnie beat John. Finally, a strange statistic for you. Despite the huge number of ranking events won between them, Judd Trump and Mark Selby have not played each other in a ranking final since Judd Trump's first ranking win at the 2011 China Open. Thanks for taking the time to read this and keep up the good work. Well, thank you for that, Gareth. Yeah, I mean, you're right. I mean, those meetings between them, it does show you how impressive it is that between them they've won, 14 world titles when they've had to come up, not just against, obviously, other top players, but each other as well. We'll continue. I'll get to the breakaway tour thing in a moment. But Colin Johnston in Edinburgh, halfway through and enjoying all the action from my armchair as usual. The highlight for me so far has been the middle session of the Jack Jones Sea Jolly match. Terrific drama and a prime example of what makes great watchable snooker. Century breaks frame after frame. His snooker played well, but doesn't lead to high drama. It's because there were no high breaks here that led to the drama, and that normally leads to most frames going down to the colours, combined with unexpected misses and incredible running of the balls into strange positions, leading to player frustration. The excellent commentary from yourself and Dominic just topped it off. What you said during the match was correct, in that the standard of play was hugely irrelevant to creating the drama. I even like the fact that Dominic seemed to be calling C-Jowee C-Drahee. Love Dom in the comms box. In a similar way, the Rob Milkins Pang match was also enjoyable to me. Okay, maybe for the purists because the standard was so bad in large parts of the match, but again, it was very easy to predict that there was going to be high drama at the end, as was the case in the last few frames. The thing is there, Colin, just to break in, John Spencer said, and he's absolutely right, snooker's one of the few sports where if the standard drops, if anything, it becomes more exciting. That's not true, you know, for example, athletics. If the 100 metres, you know, if it took 20 seconds to run the 100 metres, everyone would say it was terrible, obviously. And, you know, I think also maybe a sport like golf, if you know, the winning round of the Open was like 83 or something, people would say that's no good. But actually in snooker, I don't think you want it all to be like that, but you get engrossed in, it's the mistakes that people make, and I think that gives sort of sucker to club players to think, oh, well, this game is difficult, actually. My experience is actually being experienced by the players. So, yeah, I mean, I agree. I enjoyed that session a lot, actually. Anyway, he continues. Of course, every April means the usual Crucible future discussions. I understand this, but I do find it a bit tiresome now. Having been three times to the Crucible, of course, I would like it to stay. Moving away from the venue would deal a blow to the sport, in my opinion. However, currently, more importantly, I feel, you mentioned briefly in the last episode about a potential breakaway to an alternative tour. I haven't seen much discussion around this and wonder if you're in a position to elaborate. I remember in darts when the BDO tour was split and the start of the PDC tour, and in my opinion how destructive this was to the sport at the time. I'm very concerned at talk of a breakaway tour and what this might mean for snooker and the viewing public, in my opinion dwarfing any negative potential move of the world's to a different venue or country. Well, I'll tell you all I know about this, which is not a lot, to be honest with you. And what I've heard is secondhand from a player who has been approached to play on this tour. And so he told someone else, who then told me, that there were going to be 12 events in big cities around the world, including China and America and Saudi and various other places. The minute I heard that, I thought this is too good to be true. But anyway, this is what we were told. It'll be 12 events, 16 players on the tour, which doesn't really make it a tour as such. That's sort of an elite circuit, if you like. Various players have signed non-disclosure agreements to not discuss it in public. This player hadn't signed one, so he was discussing it in private, but actually he was entitled to. The players have been offered upwards of 300,000 and some even more to play on it. Now, presumably, and this wasn't information that I heard, but presumably it would prohibit them playing on the World Snooker Tour. World Snooker obviously got wind of this, and they put out a letter to all players saying they were relaxing the rules on what tournaments they could and couldn't play. And you remember the whole business about the Macau exhibitions and clashes. And essentially what they're saying is you can play in any tournament as long as it doesn't clash with one of our events. Now, of course, it's hard to schedule other events against the World Snooker Tour calendar because the calendar's so full. So it's not easy for an independent promoter to come along and schedule a tournament. The calendar also isn't sort of known that far in advance. I mean, even next season, there's slots that might be filled by other tournaments. There's talk of a tournament in Qatar in the second half of next season. So if you're an independent promoter, it's not actually easy to sort of avoid clashes. But it seems that the impetus behind the tour is to sort of for it to be a completely separate thing. I don't really understand, though. I mean, one of the arguments the players had about the World Snooker Tour contract, and you can understand this, but it's that it's too restrictive and it's telling them what they can and can't play in. So why would you then sign another contract that tells you what you can and can't play in? Or is it just because you're getting paid a lot of money for it? But I was... the last time there was talk of a breakaway... and by the way, it's been compared to LIV Golf, which I don't think is helpful, actually, to this apparent new tour, because LIV Golf has been brilliant for the players who have earned a fortune from it. But they don't have a broadcast contract, and their events don't have a lot of credibility. No one really follows them or knows who wins them or who doesn't win them. The majors in golf and the big events in golf are still on the PGA Tour and the what's now called the DP World Tour, which is in Europe. But anyway, I was the last time there was talk of a breakaway was over 20 years ago now, and I was sort of on the fringes of it because I was working at the time for 110 Sport on their website. They just set up their website. I was working on that. And they announced, it was a management group, they announced they'd got all this funding from the city to set up a rival tour. They announced they were going to do it. I can tell you for a fact, they announced all these events. They hadn't booked any venues. They didn't have any infrastructure to run a tour. This is the problem with trying to set up a breakaway. World Snooker Tour have massive advantages. They have the infrastructure already about how to run a tour. They have long-term broadcast contracts. They have long-term agreements in China and Saudi Arabia. So they're holding all the cards, really. It's very hard to just come along. People talk about the PDC, and that, of course, over time, and ironically, it's run by Barry Hearn now and Matrim. Over time, that definitely has become a massive thing. But early on, it was a bit of a joke, really. Even though they had a lot of top players, it took a while to overtake the Lakeside World Championship run by the BDO. So this sort of previous breakaway tour, it never happened. I mean, what happened was two things that were significant. One was the World Snooker regime at the time paid a bunch of players, they called them promotional contracts, and it was, we're going to pay you money to do promotional work for us, but essentially it's to keep you on the tour. And the other thing that happened was the BBC said straight away, we're sticking with World Snooker. We're going to, whoever's in the tournaments or not in the tournaments, we're going to show the World Championship and the other events. And that's what they did with the darts as well. Over time, the Lakeside darts sort of dwindled away. But the PDC, as I say, took, well, at least a decade to become really established as a proper rival. So we don't quite know which players have or haven't signed up to this. We've heard two very well-known players who have sort of hinted at things, Mark Williams being the most obvious, talking about not playing in any more ITV events, not playing again at the Crucible. John Higgins, ahead of the World Championship, talking about... it's his last World Championship. He mentioned in the Eurosport studio something this week, something about we'll see how about the tour in the summer or something. So he suggests to me those two have been approached, certainly. And it kind of makes sense in a way for older players who are, well, I don't feel like they're at the end of their careers. Mark's just won the Tour Championship. John is still a top player. But they're probably looking at their futures thinking, we're 50 next year. We maybe don't have much longer to go. If we can earn guaranteed money, because if it is 300 grand, plus you earn prize money in the events, you know, that's a lot of money to earn without sort of slogging through the World Snooker Tour events. It might make sense to players of that age. I don't think it makes sense to younger players. They should be trying to become world champion. Otherwise, what's the point in being a snooker player? So we don't really know. But Mark Williams, I mean... if you want to pay any attention to Twitter, he was asked directly, because all this sort of cloak and dagger stuff's been going on, he was asked directly this week, are you going to play on the World Snooker Tour next season or not? And he said he would. So that suggests one of two things. Either he won't be on the breakaway tour, or if there is a breakaway tour, they're going to fit the events around the World Snooker events. The players actually are laughing, really, on this, because whether this tour happens or not, the threat of it has made World Snooker sit up and take notice. They've relaxed the rules, so the players have more freedom. And just last week, it was announced out of nowhere that the first prize at the Masters has been put up $100,000. The prize fund has been significantly increased, but the first prize has been put up $100,000. Now, that's the last event that needs a prize money increase. But the reason they've done it, of course, is because it's an event for top players. And they're saying to the top players, look, you're going to get more money if you stick with us and play in the Masters. Does anyone really think that first prize would have gone up $100,000, but for a threat of a breakaway tour? I certainly don't. So, in a way, the players, just both sort of talking about this and threatening it, have already won. And I think what Barry said, you don't need a breakaway tour, is probably true. I think next season, the World Snooker Tour will be worth more money than ever, be more tournaments than ever, more opportunities than ever. And we've seen Mark, and John as well, you know, they're quite emotional about the Crucible. They want to play there again. Of course they do. Of course they do. You don't want to miss out on that. You don't want to miss out on the Masters and all these other events while you're still a top player. If they were sort of 30 or 40 in the world, it would make more sense to look elsewhere. So that's all I know about it. There's talk around it. Judd Trump has said he's have nothing to do with it. It appears Ronnie O'Sullivan is going to stick with World Snooker. He signed a deal with Saudi Arabia. And frankly, I mean, whatever you think of Ronnie, he is massively the biggest name in the sport. If you don't have him on a separate tour, what do you have, really? So we'll see. I don't know if it's going to transpire or not, but I think the talk of it is interesting. It has made World Snooker sit up and take notice and sharpen up its act a bit. And I think also they might look at the way they've dealt with some of these independent promotions and exhibitions and so on, and the way they've dealt with the players. They might look back and think we could have handled it a bit better. I mean, let's be clear. Barry Hearn went on the radio around the time of the Macau sort of kerfuffle and was threatening to throw players out of the sport. And I know for a fact that really annoyed some of them. I spoke to one player who was involved in that, and he was absolutely raging about what had been said because he didn't think he'd done anything wrong. And he was saying he was really frustrated with the lack of kind of opportunity to talk to World Snooker about it. He said one of their executives in China just blanked him when he tried to talk about it. This is what he told me. This is what he told me. So, you know, this has contributed to this. But I think my own sort of analysis is, I think the World Snooker Tour, the idea that this is going to sink them is fantasy. They've got they're holding all the cards. They've got all the contracts. And if they've got the top players as well, then the tour will continue. But the thing is, it would be nice to think that if there is an opportunity for events in, you know, big cities around the world, that could happen. I mean, I wrote when the Hong Kong event happened in 2022, I said we need more elite events in big cities around the world. And if that's what this is, I'm all for it. And if they could work together, and that's a big if because there's a lot of ego involved, but if they could work together, the two sides, then the tour could expand and there could be more snooker and fans in different parts of the world would get a chance to watch the tournaments. That would be the ideal scenario rather than the sort of split and people at loggerheads. That doesn't really achieve anything. So we'll follow this with interest, but at the moment there's no more meat on the bones about whether it's going to happen, who's going to be involved, how it's going to work, how you can watch it, any of that stuff. There may be announcements after the World Championship, we'll see, but at the moment it's still sort of cloaked in a bit of mystery, and there's no player come forward yet and stated definitively that they'll be playing on it, which I think is quite interesting at this stage. Let's change the tone completely with Kerry Richards, who says, a quick email on players' drinks during matches at the Crucible, or anywhere else for that matter. Clearly there's some sponsorship afoot with the brand of bottled water supplied throughout the World Championship. However, are players obliged to drink this, and only this, for commercial reasons, or could they request orange juice, squash or a Coke, for example? Linked to this is Mark Allen, who regularly cups what looks like a hot mug of something. He's seemingly the only player to do this. Mark and I have very little in common, but we both lost a fair bit of weight in recent years. I know I now feel the cold a lot more than I used to, I'm guessing due to the reduced padding. Just wondered whether this explains Mark's choice of drink, or is this down to some other reason? Thanks, as always, for your sterling efforts with the podcast. Thank you, Kerry. I think Mark Allen, he just likes to keep his hands warm. I think that's what that is. They do have a bottled water deal, so you couldn't take in sort of Highland Spring or, you know, other brands are available and drink that. A bit like the old days with the cigarettes. You could actually smoke a different brand of cigarette, but it had to be in an embassy packet at the World Championship. Seems a long time ago, all that. I'm not sure if they can take in a Diet Coke or something. I mean, if you look back over the years, most people have just drunk the water that's been there. That kind of, it's sort of, you think of Steve Davis sipping it. But what they do have now backstage is they can actually request, it doesn't seem a big thing, but it is relatively new. They can request what drinks they want in their dressing room. So they can fill out a form or whatever, and or an email, whatever it is, and say, I want this, that, and the other. It's not quite a rider, but they can request that. There used to be a chap there years ago, Dave Fisher, lovely bloke, actually, and he would be the player's liaison officer, and he would get them whatever they needed in that score. And Dave also would, he'd be the man, in the days of the Crucible Curtain, when they were introduced, he'd be the man who pulled the curtain open. Kind of miss that curtain now. There's a great sense of anticipation about it. Now they just walk on, which is fair enough. Anyways, but that doesn't quite answer your question, but it goes towards answering it, I think. Richard Adamfi writes, as I'm learning Dutch, what a start to an email that is. As I'm learning Dutch, I sometimes read snooker coverage on the website of the Flemish public broadcaster VRT, which is arguably better than what's on the BBC's website. When I saw the headlines, John Higgins in, 1-8 finales, I immediately thought, why don't we have that in English? We have the final, semi-final and quarter-final, but not the eighth final. It suddenly occurred to me that the terms round of 16 and last 16 used in English are workarounds. I don't know what to say to that, really, but anyway, we continue. How much of the other table are commentators such as yourself able to watch when commentating? Sometimes Eurosport Discovery Plus commentators are able to give a fairly detailed summary of what has happened on the other table when there's a gap in play on the commentary table, for example, between frames. Not just statistics, but also incidents that happened. For example, when a player missed an easy ball or played a great safety shot, viewers, of course, have the luxury of being able to choose which table to watch. But sometimes I feel sorry for the commentators that they have to commentate on a match less interesting. Well, believe me, when the rotor comes through, that's the first thing we look at. well, maybe it'd be helpful, Richard, to sort of give you an overview of how it works at Eurosport. So say, if we're on at 10 o'clock, I would get to the studio probably about 9 o'clock. I've already done a lot of research because I do the player profiles for the broadcasters anyway, so I've done all that already. But I would print those off. I would print off the order of play for the day. I would print off, Rolf Kaub sends a document through each day. It's the draw, centuries updated, and various other things, which are very helpful because Rolf's retiring, so that's going to stop. But they're the things I would have with me. The producer will come into the commentary room. The other commentators will be there as well. The morning producer will come in with the copy of what we call the running order, which is essentially the script, because the BBC, they come on at 10, but the play then starts about 10 minutes later. So we fill with various features, so it's just explaining what I need to introduce. You know, it might be interviews or highlights of other matches, how much time we have to do that. So we'll go through that, and then we'll start the broadcast. And obviously the broadcast will last as long as it lasts. In terms of what we can see, we have a laptop, which gives us they call it the fruit machine, which is the stats, you know, pot success, safety success, long pot success, all that stuff, for each table. And above that on the laptop is a feed of each table. Now, obviously, on the match we're commentating on, we have a proper feed of that. But, yeah, you can see the other match. To be honest, I tend not to refer to it unless I'm told to, because I think people, if they want to watch it, can watch it. Sometimes people like to watch the match after the fact, and it's quite hard to ignore the scores, but if they don't want to hear, I think if people want to know what's happening on the other table, they can find out. So I tend not to discuss what's happened in it. I'm trying to focus on my own match. Other commentators like to talk about it. That's up to them. But I like to leave it alone personally. But yeah, we can see it. And obviously, you know, if there's a sort of dramatic, you know, black ball finish or something, you do tend to be drawn to it. But I try and concentrate, for obvious reasons, on the match I'm commentating on. Lars Johansson, who Lars has headlined his email, Crexit Schmexit, he says, how come no one's talking about the important fact that Joe O'Connor is the only player in the history of the game that has a 100% winning margin at the Crucible? Well, so far, that might change. That might change tonight. In other news, 888 seems almost a certainty at this stage. Can't see anyone getting in the way. Thanks as always for your great podcast and commentating. You're talking about Ronnie. Well, I can. I don't think he played great against Ryan Day. It's a long way to go yet. I wouldn't be handing Ronnie the trophy yet. He's the favourite. He should be the favourite. But as it stands, You know, there are other people who could beat him. Obviously, potentially Trump in the semis. Someone like Mark Allen in the final. Matt Tarrant. Quick question. Are the tight pockets down to WST's tight pockets? Allen confirmed in his breakfast pod that the table pockets are tight and that he's backed up by fewer centuries. Could this be down to WST trying to save shelling out additional prize money for the two Triple Crown maximums? I don't think so, Matt. I'm not a fan of conspiracy theories. And I have complete respect for the table fitters. There are other factors at play, I think. As I say, the weather, the changeable weather does affect playing conditions. It just feels like the pockets are playing tighter. And we're only talking sort of fractional differences between maybe last year. But yeah, it has made a difference. But I don't subscribe to conspiracy theories. Lucas writes, I listened to your latest episode on Saturday night before the evening session. One listener asked if the players could hear the commentary from the headphones in the crowd. Well, less than an hour after I listened to the podcast, in the first frame of the Lazowski-Bingham match, Leo Scullion had to remind the audience to turn the sound down because he could hear it at the table. Maybe Mr. Scullion is a fan of your podcast as well. Well, the earpieces are very, you know, excuse me, if you sat in the front row, you know, you're very close to the action. You can hear it bleeding through. It's, it's more of an issue at a small venue, I guess. Lucas continues, at the beginning of the same match, there was a situation I've never really thought about before. Lazowski wanted to use the spider, then changed his mind and used the swan. Or maybe it was the other way around, I don't remember. However, the spider was still lying on the table during the shot. That made me wonder whether there are rules on what can be on the table during a shot. I don't think it's a problem, because Leo Scullion didn't object. Thanks as always for the smallest, but also the best snooker pocket out there. I hope you and all the listeners enjoy the games at the Crucible. Thank you. Not as such rules, but, I mean, obviously the more furniture you have on the table, the more chance of the cue ball hitting something. I mean, it's not a great idea to keep stuff on the table you don't need there, I suppose. But I don't think it's specifically covered, no, in the rules. I don't think so. There are referees who listen to this. Hello, Marcel Eckhart, if you're out there. But it doesn't make any sense to have too much stuff on the table, I guess, because more chance of a foul. Now, Luke Bishop has been at the Crucible, and Luke, this is what he says. Hope you're well enjoying the championship. I can report on a banal meeting with a snooker player that's had a possible effect on the match. Okay, so this is stepping up our regular feature, banal meetings with snooker players, where nothing of any importance is really happens. But anyway, it may be that on this occasion, it has. Anyway, we'll continue. First, I will belatedly give you a snooker player's cigarette name. Zhang and a packet of Lambert and Butler, please. See, I don't understand that, but anyway, thank you. I'll tell you my most memorable snooker montage song is Desiree and You Gotta Be from 1995. I recorded this on video and will watch it repeatedly over the days in my first post-Crucible come down, despite watching the last Henry Jimmy final the year before. And this was the exchange he had with his father. Dad, I want the young blonde guy to win. His father says, no, you don't, son. 95 was the first time I really engaged with the snooker, recording the highlights every night and getting up early to watch it before school the next day. On to the meat and potatoes of this email. My banal meeting with a snooker player. I happened to be in Sheffield on Saturday, sadly without tickets, but I took the opportunity to wander around the winter gardens and sample the atmosphere outside the Crucible. As I was heading towards my car, I walked past the stage exit of the Great Theatre, and who should come barreling out but the Wizard of Wishaw. I'd seen him playing on a screen just minutes before, so he clearly grabbed his cue as the session ended and bolted, obviously in a rush to, he says, GTFO. I won't elaborate what that means, but anyway. This didn't stop some Charlie mugging him for a selfie, which John kindly obliged. Determined not to harass him further, I didn't break stride towards my car park. I was also minutes away from being charged another fiver. Yet John turned and walked straight into my path, and we were suddenly rapidly approaching face to face. As our eyes locked, I felt I should say something, so without slowing down, I wished him good luck and got a cheers pal in return. Fast forward to their second session, and John was indeed blessed several slices of the good fortune I wished him. That swerve out of a snooker on a red over the pocket that subsequently snookered Alan, Mark going in off from the DDK on a red that John's break-off had stuck up over the middle, and John fluking a red into the same pocket after missing a long pot to the corner by a mile, enabling him to go on and win that frame and go 7-5 up. However, sadly, the luck did not continue, as you know, and John lost the next four frames. Perhaps I should have wished him more good luck, although I'm not sure how I could have done this. I can only apologise to John for this. So not entirely a banal meeting for you there. No worries, we don't read this out. Well, I have read it out, and that's the point, isn't it? You wished him luck, he got a bit, but you didn't stipulate how much luck. So really, Luke, what we're saying is it's your fault that John is 9-7 down overnight. Now, if you see him, maybe Luke, around today, you could wish him more luck. But anyway, we'll see. We'll see. It would be interesting. If he comes back and wins, then maybe actually the luck you wished him was sufficient. We'll see. If he wins with a fluke in the decider, I think it's down to you. Speaking of luck, and this is what's known as a segue, we have here, well, I think it's Joseph, or Declan, anyway, Declan. Lady Luck, an ever-present character on the snooker table, and a jewel in the Crucible Crown each year, always creates mixed reactions amongst players and the audience alike. I think luck is to be celebrated, as its presence is a testimony to the complexity of the game. Life and the struggle for it day and night over the entire surface of the earth involves the play of chance, tragically and comically, beautifully and horribly. A game that can catch or reflect something of this great fact of life should not be begrudged. When Lady Luck smiles, always smile back, and don't get too downcast, or you might offend her. This lady is ultimately very fair and reserves a smile for everyone if they know how to appreciate it and wait patiently. It's quite philosophical there, but I mean, there's no doubt that luck does play a big part in snooker. That's just a fact. Now, we'll end. We will be back later in the week, so if your email hasn't been read out, hopefully we'll get to it later in the week, but there's other things going on, such as the World Championship. Nick writes, so this is the final email this week. Hello, Dave. Greetings from Greece. I'm a relatively new listener, and after listening to some episode podcasts, finally it's time for the World Championship, and it's really nice to hear your voice in the commentary. Thank you, Nick. I have a bizarre question. It's something that's been bothering me for many, many years. I've tried everything. I've asked even professional players here. Karen Billy is not snooker players, and nobody seems to have an answer. So, number one, how can snooker players use the chalk and not get messy in their pockets and or on their hands? Number two, how can they put the chalk in and out so quickly without ever looking at it? And they always know which is the correct side, and they do it both in their vests and in their pants. I'm not kidding you, it's driving me crazy. Do they have a system and only putting it in a certain way? Are they getting messy and the cameras don't show? Are they marking the chalk from underneath in a way to know the right side? Hope this question entertains you a little, but know that my frustration is real, and I'd really appreciate a conclusion to my never-ending turmoil. Thanks for your time. Please continue to be awesome. Well, this is an extraordinary email. I think the answer to question two, it becomes just muscle memory, I suppose. You're just instinctive, like anything you do. I'm boiling the kettle. You don't think how to do it because you've done it so many times. So I think it's just instinctive. They reach into the pocket and grab the chalk and put it back, and it's all just instinctive to them. In terms of, I mean, we don't... You know, we see a lot at the Crucible and of players in general. We don't see the inside of their pockets, and we don't really want to. They may be just covered in chalk for all we know. We don't know. That's the point. It's hidden. You would think they probably are, because, like you say, you know, the chalk is going to sort of transfer itself to the material, you would think. So I suspect, you know, that their pockets are messy, but we don't really want to see that. And I think their hands, if you look close up on their hands, you would see chalk on them for sure. What's interesting is because so many people use the finish chalk now, the tables are not sort of marked with chalk like they used to be. Luca Brasel went back to the old chalk for some reason. It didn't seem to do him any good. Of course, Ronnie uses it. Again, we don't really know why. But hopefully that goes somewhere to answering your question. I suspect that they are a bit of a mess with it. But we don't see that, and we don't want to, frankly. So this first edition of the second week. We're back later in the week, so do continue to email us, snookerscenepodcast@mail.com. That's snookerscenepodcast@mail.com. I think the Crucible debate might go quiet now. We might hear more about the potential breakaway tour, I don't know. But the main thing is we're watching the World Championship, and savour it as long as it's here. Because we don't know what's going to happen with it in the future or where it's going to go. But let's just enjoy it while it is here. A great highlight. We heard some great emails earlier about the Crucible. And hopefully people are enjoying it all. So that's it for now. We're members of the Sports Social Network and all of that. But continue to enjoy the event. I think from the quarterfinals onwards, it steps up a bit. I think second round. One thing I'd say, just finally on the scheduling. There was one finish on Sunday. That's unavoidable because, you know, the round stretches on for so many days. But a lot of people made the point that the Maguire-Murphy finish, which was very interesting, was on the same time as Ronnie O'Sullivan's first session of his match. And Ronnie's always going to be on the telly, and he just will, and that's it, okay, because he's the most popular player. But why schedule the finish opposite that session when he could have been on in the evening or more likely the afternoon, which is a better slot for telly. Here's my question, really. Why is it all scheduled? Why is it all set in stone weeks in advance? Why? I can understand the first round. Okay, yeah, we want to schedule those matches, let everyone know when they're playing. At Wimbledon, they announce the schedule the day before. Okay, so you find out the previous afternoon when you're playing the next day, and everyone just seems to cope with that. Why does it all have to be set in stone so much in the future? Maybe as the first round results are coming in, you could decide, okay, maybe we want this second round match here. Players have to know, obviously, when they're playing. I understand that. But it doesn't have to be so regimented. And even the semi-finals. Now, I think if Trump plays O'Sullivan in the semis, I think that's the second semi-final, so it would conclude on the Saturday night. But let's just say, for argument's sake, it was in the other half of the draw. I think the BBC would rather, because they are actually aren't going to be live on that Saturday night, they would rather Trump O'Sullivan finished in the evening. So why? But at the moment, you couldn't switch it round, because it's all just decided in advance. And the only reason it's decided in advance to that extent is nothing to do with tickets, because they're already sold. It's just because it's always been done that way. Surely there could be more flexibility. So, for example, on Sunday, they could have organised that day better and had more interest in a more interesting afternoon session with a finish, rather than the finish being up against Ronnie in the morning. It just seems there's so many things in this sport that are kind of just done because they've always been done. And if we're going to move forward, you know, and be more kind of relevant, they feel like small things, but they need to be looked at, I think. The schedule is weird, and maybe the whole tournament's weird, I don't know. Well, I do know, it is. It's an eccentric event, and we're eccentric people enjoying it. But it could be looked at, I think, that's all I'm saying. And maybe next year they could be a bit more flexible. You don't need to know, like, weeks in advance who might be playing which quarter-final session. It doesn't make any sense. Anyway, that's the ending of the show. So continue to enjoy the coverage. And as we always say, goodbye-bye. Sports Social Podcast Network.